going to be reading a whole series of verses, like 20 or something like that, starting from Canto 3, Chapter 8, text number 11, running through the end of the chapter, which is text 33. Canto 3, Chapter 8. Context here is, in the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, in the beginning verses, Krishna says, nobody knows me. Nobody can know me. No one can know the source of their existence from which they've come by any amount of investigative work, by any amount of empiric study. Because the obvious is, if something existed before you existed, how can you research that? You can do some guesswork, but you can't know. So he says the great sages, the great rishis, the demigods, nobody knows what existed before they existed. Psychiatrists certainly don't know. That there's the perhaps maybe, but in my opinion, it seems to me that. But one cannot know conclusively. And then Krishna turns around and reveals it. Because that which is the source can disclose. And with Arjuna, he chooses to disclose. But if that disclosure isn't there, you can't know conclusively. And there's also a place in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna describes, there's a place which, after the entire cosmic dissolution, cosmic manifestation is dissolved and destroyed, there's a place that remains. And that very place that remains is the abode of the Lord, and it's from that place that remains that the subsequent creation and generation comes, that from which everything comes. So how do you know that? You can't know that. Back to the 10th chapter, you can't, by your investigative methodology, you can't. But by disclosure, you can. So this section that we're going to read is disclosure from the Supreme Personality of Godhead on the topic of what existed before we existed. How can you verify that? By empiric method, you can't verify that. You can't disprove it. You can't prove it by empiric method. The only way, so bhaktyamam abhijanati yavanyaschas, the only way that one can know Krishna is through devotion. And the converse is not otherwise. So like that, yesterday evening I made reference to this question as a small boy. It's like a tourist advertisement. If you want to go to Acapulco or Siberia or Moscow or Paris, or like, what's the promotional information about the place? Why should I want to go there? What's it like there? So here's that description, where the title of the chapter is Manifestation of Brahma from Vishnu, and what follows is then what Brahma does. Brahma's prayers for creative energy. That place where Lord Brahma comes from is spiritual. It's that part that's not destroyed when cosmic annihilation takes place. What we're hearing is the birth of the first birth of our Lord Brahma, or at least a Lord Brahma, because they're different Lord Brahmas. There's different universes, so there's different Brahmas. And then those universes are recycled. Vedic picture of time is cyclical, so after the universe is created, maintained, and annihilated, and brought to rest, then another. So there's unlimited Lord Brahmas. And what we're hearing is slightly different than Sri Brahma Samhita. At least some detail or details are left out. It doesn't mean that they didn't happen. It's just, you know, the way the Prabhupada describes, like the appearances of the forms of the Lord, the essences are displayed by the Lord, and there's variations each time the Lord appears, because variety is the mother of enjoyment. So he doesn't do the same thing every time. There's a certain theme, and then there's variety. And so there's some details that are slightly different. That doesn't mean, oh, what's going on? Is this right? Or that, is that one right? And why is there a contradiction? There's variation, but the theme is essentially the same. The person that's narrating is Maitreya, and he's narrating to Vidura. And before he begins this narration, he says, what he heard was from Parashara Muni, who heard from Sankhyayana Muni, who heard from the four Kumaras, who directly heard from Lord Sankarshan. That's a disciplic succession from the Kumaras. We have four disciplic successions. This is one of them. He heard from that disciplic succession. And what he heard, so the description in the earlier parts of this chapter is that the four Kumaras, along with many sages, they descended through the Ganges. They descended down to the, just like this nice depiction on the wall here, to where Anantashesh, Lord Sankarshan, resides. They went there and they presented many questions. Maitreya says, very similar, Vidura, to the ones that you've just presented to me. Many questions. The Lord, Sankarshan, being very enthused by those questions, he gave many answers. Then the Kumaras discussed the same subject matter in the presence of Parashara, and Brihaspati was also there, and some others heard. Sankhyayana Muni was told by the Kumaras. Sankhyayana spoke when Parashara was present. Parashara, on the advice of Pulastya, spoke it to Maitreya. Now Maitreya said, I'm going to speak. He refers to it as the Bhagavatam, the best of the Puranas. And Prabhupada in parentheses is Bhagavatam. In the purport, Prabhupada explains, Vyasadeva wrote the Bhagavatam, he compiled it, but it existed previously in a different sampradaya, which is fine, because it's direct glorification of the personality of Godhead. That's what Bhagavat Purana is, a history glorifying Bhagavan. So that's the background. And then I'll start with text 10. Mainly I'm going to be reading the verses, a little bit from the purports. There's not a lot of purport, by the way, also. At that time, when the three worlds were submerged in the water, now we're in that cycle of time, it's at the cosmic devastation. All the three worlds, upper, middle, lower planetary systems, submerged. Garbhadakshay Vishnu was alone, lying on his bedstead, the great snake Ananta. And although he appeared to be in slumber, in his own internal potency, free from the action of the external energy, because everything is submerged and dormant, his eyes were not completely closed. Just like the strength of fire within fuel wood, the Lord remained within the water of dissolution, submerging all the living entities in their subtle bodies. He lay in the self-invigorated energy called Kala. In the purport, Prabhupada says, thus the material energy was not completely wound up, as in the case of the full dissolution of the material world. That's a partial dissolution. That's the night of Brahma. The Lord lay down for 4,000 yuga cycles. So 1,000 yuga cycles is Manu's duration. So four of those. In his internal potency, and by his external energy, he appeared to be sleeping within the water. When the living entities were coming out for further development of their fruitive activities, actuated by the energy called Kala Shakti, he saw his transcendental body as bluish. In the purport, Prabhupada writes, due to this polluted mentality, tendency for material activities and sinful activities, and due to material sins, the aggregate combination of living entities appeared to be bluish. Such an impetus of activity for fruitive result is made possible by the dictation of the external energy of the Lord Kala. That's a little curious, because in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, time I am, which makes it sound like his internal energy or something, Kala Shakti. But specifically here, it's his external energy under his direction and according to the arrangements of Kala Shakti, arrangements of time, the time for the living entities to again manifest their fruitive activities was coming, and so they were starting to again become activated. Next. The subtle subject matter of creation on which the Lord's attention was fixed was agitated by the material mode of passion. The Lord wasn't agitated, but the subject matter upon which he was contemplating was agitated by the mode of passion. And thus, the subtle form of creation pierced through his abdomen. That's a pretty interesting gestation. Next, no purport. Piercing through this sum total of the form of fruitive activity of the living entities took shape as the bud of a lotus flower generated from the personality of Vishnu, and by his supreme will it illuminated everything like the sun and dried up the vast waters of devastation. So this lotus bud is not metaphorical and it's not ordinary. Luminous, sum total form of fruitive activities of living entities. Not the activities themselves, but the subtle sum total form of the... this lotus appeared brilliant, illuminating everything, and the waters of devastation, partial devastation, being dried up. So like that picture of the universe there, half of the universe becomes inundated up to and including the heavenly planets, so more than half, and dissolved or suspended. Those waters of devastation subside in the purport. Prabhupada writes, this lotus flower is the universal Virat form. Did you know that? I didn't know that either. Virat Rupa, like Krishna shows to Arjuna, the universal form. And the lotus upon which Lord Brahma appears, according to this purport, they're identical. This lotus flower is the Virat form. So what appeared from the Lord was the lotus, or what appeared from the Lord's abdomen was the universal form, or Virat. The gigantic form of the Lord in the material world, the Virat, or the lotus, becomes amalgamated in the personality Godhead, Vishnu, in his abdomen at the time of dissolution. The universe becomes amalgamated. Amalgamated. What does that mean? Like, merged within? Still existing, but not differentiated from himself? Amalgamated? In a subtle way, amalgamated. And then, again, manifested in a grosser form. So it's existing in the dissolution period, and then again, makes its appearance, unamalgamated, I guess. And it becomes manifest at the time of creation. This is due to Garbhadaksha Vishnu, who enters into each of the universes. Like, so Garbhadaksha Vishnu is an agent, or an instrument, or a nimitta. This is described in, it's a very subtle, maybe even complex, more subtle subject matter discussed in Chaitanya Charitamrita in relation to Advaitacharya and his role as Mahavishnu. As we know him as Mahavishnu, he's a specific aspect of Mahavishnu. He's the material cause as opposed to the ingredient cause. Anyway, rather than going into that subtle distinction, it's Vishnu who holds that potential, that potency, and according to his will, withdraws it. According to his will, maintains it in that withdrawn state. According to his will, he manifests it. He's not dictated by his Kala Shakti, because it's his energy, but according to the arrangements of time. When there's a time of dissolution, there's a time of manifestation. And as that wheel of time moves, then the Lord contemplates the subject, which is the object of creation, and the virat, or this lotus, appears. This is due to Garbhadakshay Vishnu, who enters into each of the universes in this form, is the sum total of all the fruitive activities of all living entities conditioned by material nature, and the first of them, namely Brahma, or the controller of the universe, is generated from this lotus flower. And he appears at the top. The universal form at the top is Lord Brahma. This firstborn living being, unlike all the others, has no material father, and thus he is called self-born or Swayambhu. He goes to sleep with Narayan at the time of devastation, that's the partial, his night, and when there is another creation, he is born in this way. From this description, we have the conception of three: the gross virat form. It's not so gross, it's not easily seen. The subtle Hiranyagarbha. Who is Hiranyagarbha? Garbhadakshay Vishnu. And the material creative force, comma, Brahma. End of purport. So now we're at text 16, we're heading for 33. Brahma, born out of the lotus flower, could not see the world. World. It wasn't one. It was dissolved. Although he was situated in the whorl, W-H-O-R-L. So atop this lotus stem was a lotus flower. He was atop, he was on the whorl of that lotus flower, and he couldn't see the rest of the creation because it was dissolved. He therefore circumambulated all of space and while moving his eyes in all directions, he achieved four heads in terms of the four directions. No purport. Text 17. Brahma, situated in that lotus, could not perfectly understand the creation, the lotus, or himself. At the end of the millennium, the air of devastation began to move the water and the lotus in great circular waves. There's a purport, short. Lord Brahma was perplexed about his creation, the lotus, and the world, even though he tried to understand them for one millennium, the duration of one yuga cycle, apparently, the cycle of four yugas, which is beyond the calculation in solar years of human beings. No one, therefore, can know the mystery of the creation and cosmic manifestation simply by mental speculation. I mean, who's going to figure this one out? The human being is so limited in his capacity that without the help of the Supreme, he can hardly understand the mystery of the will of the Lord in terms of creation, continuance, and destruction. End of purport. Text 18, Lord Brahma, in his ignorance, contemplated, who am I that I am situated on the top of this lotus? Wherefrom has it sprouted? There must be something downwards, and that from which this lotus has grown must be within the water. That's deductive logic. an inquisitive spirit. Lord Brahma, thus contemplating, entered the water through the channel of the stem of the lotus. So, like deductive logic, let me just go follow this down and down and down and down, and wherever it came from, that's where I came from. Well, in spite of entering the stem and going nearer to the navel of Vishnu, he could not trace out the root of Vidura. While searching in that way about his existence, Brahma reached his ultimate time. No purport. What's the ultimate time? Which is the eternal wheel in the hand of Vishnu. So, wheel, chakra. And which generates fear in the mind of the living entity, like the fear of death. No purport. Thereafter, being unable to achieve the desired destination, doesn't say he heard tapa three times, just doesn't mention it, doesn't say it didn't happen, just doesn't mention it. He retired from such searching and came back again to the top of the lotus, thus controlling all objectives. He concentrated his mind on the Supreme Lord. Prabhupada writes, each and every living entity needs to engage in devotional service to the Lord if he wishes to understand the ultimate cause of his existence. To cease from personal sense endeavors and to concentrate on the supreme cause is a sign of self-surrender, and when self-surrender is present, this is a sure sign of devotional service. So the next verses are describing what he saw in his meditation. At the end of Brahma's 100 years, when his meditation was complete, this is Brahma's 100 years, he lived for 100 years. This part is, to me, it's contradictory. I don't understand. At the end of Brahma's 100 years, when his meditation was complete, he developed the required knowledge, and as a result, he could see in his heart the Supreme within himself, whom he could not see before, with the greatest endeavor. So Prabhupada writes in the purport, the age of Brahma is calculated in terms of divya years, which are distinct from the solar years of the human being. The divya years are calculated in Bhagavad Gita 8:17, Sahasra Yuga Paryantam Aryad Brahmanovidu. Brahma's one day is equal to 1,000 times the aggregate of the four yugas, or 1,000 times 4,300,000, so it's 4,300,000,000. That's one day. On that basis, Brahma meditated for 100 years before he could understand the supreme cause of all causes, and then he wrote Brahma Samhita. That's maybe 100 of our years instead of 100 of his years, because it wouldn't make sense. 100 of his years, he's finished. And then write Brahma Samhita and do what? And die. And then the universe is over. So it's, anyway, perhaps 100 of our years. One has to wait for the mercy of the Lord before one can render a service unto him or know him as he is. Text 23. Brahma could see that on the water, there was a gigantic lotus-like white bedstead, the body of Sheshanag, on which the personality of Godhead was lying alone. The whole atmosphere was illuminated by the rays of the jewels bedecking the hood of Sheshanag, and that illumination dissipated all the darkness of those regions. The person who's speaking this, remember, is Lord Sankarshan. He's explaining this to the Kumaras. The luster of the transcendental body of the Lord mocked the beauty of the coral mountain. The coral mountain is very beautifully dressed by the evening sky, but the yellow dress of the Lord mocked its beauty. There is gold on the summit of the mountain, but the Lord's helmet, bedecked with jewels, mocked it. The mountains, waterfalls, herbs, etc., with a panorama of flowers, seem like garlands, but the Lord's gigantic body and his hands and legs, decorated with jewels, pearls, tulsi leaves and flower garlands, mocked the scene on the mountain. In the purport, Prabhupada writes, in Bhagavad Gita 2.59, it is described that one who is attracted by Param, the Supreme, is no longer attracted by anything inferior. Text 25. His transcendental body, unlimited in length and breadth, occupied the three upper planetary systems, upper, middle, and lower. Occupied the three planetary systems, upper, middle, and lower. His body was self-illuminated by unparalleled dress and variegatedness, and was properly ornamented. The Lord showed his lotus feet by raising them. His lotus feet are the source of all awards achieved by devotional service, free from material contamination. Such awards are for those who worship him in pure devotion. The splendor of those transcendental rays from his moon-like toenails and fingernails appeared like the petals of a flower. And the purport, Prabhupada speaks about Krishna in Goloka. According to Gopala Tapani Upanishad, the Lord showed one of the many thousands of petals of his lotus feet. It is said, Brahmano asva anavaratamme dhyataha stutaha paradhante sabudaya gopavesho me prastat avirbhavo. Avirva Buha. So he paraphrases. After penetrating for millions of years, Lord Brahma could understand the transcendental form of the Lord as Sri Krishna in the dress of a cowherd boy. And thus he recorded his experience in Brahma Samhita and the famous prayers, Govindam Adipurusham Tamaham Bhajami. So, preliminary is, for the purpose of creation, there's Lord Vishnu, who is his source and is his energizing agent or on whose behalf he carries out the creation. So this is describing his realization of that form of the Lord, and the Brahma Samhita prayers are describing the original personality of Godhead. Text 27. He also acknowledged the service of the devotees and vanquished their distress by his beautiful smile. The reflection of his face, decorated with earrings, was so pleasing because it dazzled with the rays from his lips and the beauty of his nose and eyebrows. Nice purport. Devotional service to the Lord is very much obliging to him. There are many transcendentalists in different fields of spiritual activities, but devotional service to the Lord is unique. Devotees do not ask anything from the Lord in exchange for their service. Even the most desirable liberation is refused by the devotees, although offered by the Lord. Thus the Lord becomes a kind of debtor to the devotees, and he can only try to repay the devotee's service with his ever-enchanting smile. The devotees are ever satisfied with the smiling face of the Lord, and they become enlivened. And by seeing the devotees so enlivened, the Lord himself is further satisfied. So there is continuous transcendental competition between the Lord and the devotees by such reciprocation of service and acknowledgement. Text 28. O my dear Vidura, the Lord's waist was covered with yellow cloth resembling the saffron dust of the kadamba flower, and it was encircled by a well-decorated belt. His chest was decorated with a shrivatsa marking and a necklace of unlimited value. Kastupa. As a sandalwood tree is decorated with fragrant flowers and branches, the Lord's body was decorated with valuable jewels and pearls. He was the self-situated tree, the Lord of all others in the universe. And as a sandalwood tree is covered with many snakes, so the Lord's body was also covered by the hoods of Ananta. Like a great mountain, the Lord stands as the abode for all moving and non-moving living entities. He is the friend of the snakes because Lord Ananta is his friend. As a mountain has thousands of golden peaks, so the Lord was seen with the thousands of golden helmeted hoods of Ananta Naga. And as a mountain is sometimes filled with jewels, so also his transcendental body was fully decorated with valuable jewels. As a mountain is sometimes submerged in the ocean water, so the Lord is sometimes submerged in the water of devastation. Text 31, Lord Brahma. We're almost done. Thus, looking upon the Lord in the shape of a mountain, concluded that he was Hari, the personality of Godhead. He saw that the garland of flowers on his chest glorified him with Vedic wisdom in sweet songs and looked very beautiful. He was protected by the Sudarshana wheel for fighting, and even the sun, moon, air, fire, etc. could not have access to him. Again, no purport to all of this. Text 32. Two more verses. When Lord Brahma, the maker of the universal destination, thus saw the Lord, he simultaneously glanced over creation. Remember, it doesn't exist yet. So it's subtle or unmanifest. So within his mind, that kind of glancing, like contemplation. The Lord saw the lake in Lord Vishnu's navel and the lotus flower, as well as the devastating water, the drying air, and the sky. All became visible to him. Last verse. Lord Brahma, thus being surcharged with the mode of passion, became inclined to create, and after seeing the five causes of creation indicated by the personality of Godhead, he began to offer his respectful prayers on the path of the creative mentality. The last little purport. Even if one is in the material mode of passion to create something in the world, he has to take shelter of the Supreme for the necessary energy. That is the path of the successful termination of any attempt. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purports of the third canto, eighth chapter, Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Manifestation of Brahma from Garbhadakshay Vishnu. And the next chapter is Brahma's Prayers for Creative Energy. And there's like long reports for all of that. So it'll be a lot easier going than we just did. But there's a description, less detail, in the second canto. This is third canto. The second canto, Narada is asking his father, Brahma, I see that you're meditating. Upon what is it that you're meditating? I thought you were the Supreme. But if you're the Supreme, why are you meditating? And if you're not the Supreme, what's Supreme? Please disclose this. I'm your son. It's your... the duty of the father to teach the son these things. And Brahma then describes that he's not the Supreme. And gives some similar descriptions earlier in the second canto. There's the first chapter is meditation on the universal form, and again during that description that Brahma gives to Narada, there's description of the universal form. Again here in this chapter, there's a description of the universal form. Not, there's much more detail in the second canto. Less emphasis here on the universal form, other than just referring to it as this lotus upon which Brahma grows or appears. At the beginning of each day of Lord Brahma's life, he has to recreate that which was dissolved during the night. So he has, like, you know, go to the office and do his work. But before he does that, he takes this impression of what is to look like, something like a subtle blueprint. And he's like, you know, the engineer and contractor that has to, like, put the thing together, build the building based upon the, or the whatever it is that you're building. In his case, it's like half of the universe, based upon the plan of the Lord. The plan of the Lord is the universal form, or the universal form is the subtle aspect of what Brahma does. So Brahma has to have, like, you know, he's a super professor. He has to know chemical engineering and mechanical engineering and civil engineering and all kinds of engineerings in order to put this thing together. And, like, he gets a clue. Doesn't have, like, a whole, you know, PhD degree to, like, figure it out so he can do it. Just his process of meditation upon the Supreme Lord does it. He gets the impression. And from the impression, he does the work of creation. So that the plan comes from the Lord, and described how that plan manifests. The ingredients come from the Lord. The creative potency comes from the Lord. The self-realization necessary to not make mistakes in the process of creation, because that would be a, you can't have that. You can't have mistakes in creation. So the everything comes from the Lord. That's of these the 10 topics of the Bhagavatam, that's one of them, sarga. And then coming up is the next one, visarga, the subcreation. And then with the subcreation comes the means of maintaining that subcreation. It's not whimsical, just create and like let it fly. Maintaining. And those who are in the dutiful position of maintaining and further populating, filling out the plan, is the manus, who derive their capacity from Brahma, starting with Swayambhuva Manu. So many things to say about this, I'll just say two. One of them is I'm accustomed to hearing Prabhupada go through the exercise of explaining why, from the Vedic perspective, we accept that there is life on other planets. The New York Times just posted this, whatever it's called, some spacecraft that went to Mercury. That's, you know, much further away than Mars and the Moon. Mercury's very far. It took pictures, sent back pictures of the surface of Mercury with, I assume, very high magnification and so on. So what's the conclusion? There's no life there. And from the Vedic perspective, there's life on the Moon, there's life on the Sun. And Prabhupada would say when they go to the Moon, if they went, what do they find? Handful of rocks and dust. So no life in the Moon. But that's their evidence and their version. We find differently from the Vedas or the Sun. And who can live in the Sun? Nobody can live in the Sun. Unless the bodies are of fiery energy, just as on this planet bodies are of earth and water elements, or in the water they're more watery on the in the earth are more earthy and less water than the aquatics. But because we can't live in the water, we would die. We can swim in the water, but we can't live in the water unless we have a body appropriate. Or there's life in the air. We can't live in the air, but there's living entities in the air. Living entities in water. There's living entities in land. Why not living entities in fire? And the Vedic information is, there's Vivaswan, the sun god, Krishna spoke to. That's our authority. So if there's a sun god, he's the ruler over something. So there's the other population in the sun. That's our information. And then Prabhupada said, so you choose. Scientist says, no life. The Vedas say, there's life. Now you choose which authority you like. But from then, just continue. And Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Sarva Gata, living entities are everywhere. That's the authority of the Vedas. So, in short, part of what it comes down to is, whose authority do you accept? And because based upon what authority you accept, that's where your knowledge comes from. Like Prabhupada said, he spoke with Professor Katovsky in Moscow and said, Professor Katovsky, there's no difference between you and me. We both accept authority. You accept the authority of Lenin. And on the authority of Lenin, your life is based. And I accept the authority of Krishna. On the authority of Krishna, my life is based. So, where's the difference? You accept Leonard and I accept Krishna. I certainly prefer to accept Krishna. And you certainly prefer to accept Leonard. On the basis of that authority, you live your life. So, just stepping back from this discussion, on what basis do we accept the Vedic authority? Why should we accept the Vedic authority? Why not accept something else? The scientist or some other authority or some other authority or our mind or whatever it is. But we all have to accept some authority. There was a period in European history when European scholars, I've heard Sariputta describe this, because both he, Sariputta, and Rabindra Sarup were both very interested in European history, because European history very much influences our experience in America, or the flow of information over a period of time. And there was a period in European history during the Renaissance period where European scholars were becoming very interested in Eastern philosophies, and particularly in Indian philosophy, and particularly within the Vedas. And the European scholarly community, taking great interest in it, was disturbing to the minds of those who had vested interests in maintaining Christian supremacy in Europe. And so, I forget the person's name, Macaulay or somebody like that from Europe, from UK, went systematically throughout Europe and said, rubbish. The Vedas are rubbish. During the British rule, it became even more acute. But the Vedas are rubbish. And here's how we're going to prove it. There are two areas where the Vedas speak about things that are empiric. And as empiric science develops, these two areas will show the empirical things are rubbish, so the rest is rubbish. And those two areas were areas of archaeology and areas of astronomy. Because archaeology, you can measure it. And astronomy, you can measure it. Because within the Vedas, it gives the fifth canto and Vishnu Purana and Mahabharata and so on. It gives descriptions of, the illustration here on the wall. It gives descriptions of the size of planets and the orbits of planets and the relative positions of things, numerical, empirical information. So as science develops, and it was like this fellow was going all over Europe, to educated people, academicians, and beating the drum and drawing the trumpet, saying rubbish. Following him came Charles Darwin, saying, archaeology is going to prove the following. Life came from... science, from that perspective, took on that area, and astronomy took on another perspective. So one of the reasons, one of the compelling reasons to accept the Vedas, just from an empiric viewpoint, is the Vedas very clearly articulated the structure of the universe in a way that modern science is gradually coming to the same numerical values. It's not like, now we can accept the Vedas because the Vedas are very close correlation, almost one-to-one correlation with what modern science says. At least, the numerical part. It's this orbits and the size of the planets and time and of the orbits and so on. Rather, it's the other way around, that the empiric science is getting a little bit more refined, a little bit more refined, up to the point of accepting. Like, an example is the Copernicus view that previously the universe was geocentric, came up with, at least our solar system is not geocentric, but heliocentric. The planets are moving around the sun. And the previous ancient, like Vedic and other systems of astronomy were geocentric. Then, in addition to that, he said the distance between the Earth and the Sun was, whatever he said, X. And it was way off. Like, way off. And as the development of technology, it got like a factor of 20 or something like that off. And then it got closer and closer and closer. And now with Hubble telescopes mounted on craft to take pictures of things and send the pictures back and do other calculations, it's almost a one-to-one correlation between the distance between the Earth and the Sun. And then as far as the heliocentric, geocentric, it's just a matter of mathematical equations. One is where the position of observation is, and then it's just relative motion. Which is revolving around which one in space is relative motion. I had this presentation once at the University of California in Berkeley on sacred universe, mysteries of the sacred universe. And one fellow was objecting, no, you can't just have relative motion. It's either this or that. Which one is it? I said, come on, you don't have to be Einstein, but you can accept that Einstein had a right statement. There's relativity. I mean, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle depends on, how you view a thing, whether it's a... You're not new to these ideas. You want something absolute. Well, it's either heliocentric or geocentric. It's relative. You get the same numbers, just plug into through a different mathematical formula, and you get the same information. Relative. What's the distance between here and here? And it works. Distance between here and here, it works. And the period of orbit. So, geocentric or heliocentric, the distance between the Earth and the Sun is now one-to-one correlation. And, the work of did Grootekarma come here already? So, that's also, we're going to show that through fossil record and everything that life is not what the Vedas say it is. It's, it's more what modern science says what it is. It's, it's evolution, chemical evolution, and more modern. Well, there's other information. So, back to what authority do we accept? And as thoughtful individuals, each one of us has to carefully consider what authority do we accept? Because it's on the basis of what authority you accept, that's your world picture. It's what Krishna says in the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, where he began this presentation, is that nobody knows what existed before we existed. You can't. You can't know conclusively. That, to me, makes sense. You can say, perhaps, maybe. It's like, at one presentation I made at the University of Houston in the Indian Graduate Student Association, IGSA, at the University of Houston. At the end of that Sacred Universe, Mysteries of the Sacred Universe presentation, one fellow stood up and raised his hand and called upon, he said, the modern science has it calculated down to milliseconds before the Big Bang. What happened? But, you know, the Big Bang, they can't figure that one out. It just, like, just defies their... So, how do you explain that? Is there anything from the Vedic perspective that says that? If the singularity, or this, whatever it is, from which the Big Bang happened, happened to be the Supreme Personality God, or to something that he gave agency, because the Vedas also describe the expanding universe, but the Vedas also describe the imploding, contracting universe in the course of cyclical time. So if that Big Bang is, you know, the expanding of the universe is from the pores of Mahavishnu, no problem. But that wasn't necessarily a bang. And that you can mathematically, you know, that's theoretical, if it actually happened that way or not. The Vedas don't address that. But each of the universes, not just one, you just take this one, but there's, according to the Vedic version, unlimited numbers that come from the portholes of Mahavishnu. Once Prabhupada was asked that question, is there anything comparable in Vedic picture to the Big Bang? And he gave something like that as a comparison. The portholes of Mahavishnu, from which everything, which the universe is emanated and develop. And they emanate and develop because Garbhadakshay Vishnu is within each of those universes. And by his presence, it expands, just like within the body of any living entity, a child, or a mosquito, or an elephant, or whatever it is, a microbial germ. Because there's a soul present, then the body develops. And when the soul leaves, the body disintegrates. Because the presence of spirit, matter moves. Without the presence of spirit, matter doesn't move or grow, or nothing, you know, nothing happens. So this description, rather than the Vedas leaving it like unspoken or blank, or, you know, just as the Old Testament does, it just says God created heaven and earth, and he did in 7 days, and one day he thought, let there be such and such, and so there was, and he said it was good. And then next day, something else, and let it be, and so it was. So, you know, that there, it's monotheism says God is the source of everything, but how does it come about? From our perspective, that Old Testament description is metaphorical or symbolical, not necessarily literal. And this description is literal, not metaphorical or symbolical. Or like the Old Testament description, that's my phone, the Old Testament description of Adam and Eve. It's Prabhupada, that there's discussions, room conversations. Prabhupada never presented this in lectures, but for the sake of the devotees' understanding, they presented different things, and the Adam and Eve story is, from our perspective, it's allegorical. It's not literally, once upon a time, there was a Garden of Eden, and there was Adam, and there was Eve, and Adam took a bite of an apple, and then, boom, you know, he fell into Maya. It's allegorical. The description of creation found in the Old Testament is not allegorical, but it's a very simplified rendering of the fact that everything comes from the Supreme Lord, and he decide by his will, Ichha Shakti, he desires something He desires, it's earlier described in this same third canto. Again, during the period of cosmic devastation, the Lord was contemplating out of love for the living entities. They have a desire. And their desire is not to be fulfilled, to enjoy happiness independent from me, but they have this desire. He's contemplating out of love for the living entities. And the second thing he contemplates is the shadow, Chaya Devi, the shadow of my internal potency, Rama Devi, she desires some service and she doesn't have something to do. So with those two contemplations, then the flow of events through the agency of his time energy take place. And without that desire, without that Ichha Shakti, there isn't creation. Things are dormant. But because just his contemplation is invested in something, then it energizes that something. He doesn't have to do anything. Through his agency, Brahma appears and he invests in Brahma this realization of him slightly differently described, but you know, from let's say from another perspective, slightly differently described in the second canto. And here we have the third canto, and next comes his prayers for creative energy. Okay, so end there. A little different kind of morning Bhagavatam class, but any discussion? Yes?
Prabhupada was talking about the self surrender.
Yeah.
So I was not able to.
Let's see if I can find it. Here's the verse in purport. It's text 21, chapter 8. Thereafter, so he tried on his own initiative, the ascending process, figure it out, search out the source of the lotus stem, then I'll find my source, because I was appearing on the stem. Unsuccessful. Thereafter, being unable to achieve the desired destination, he retired from such searching and came back again to the top of the lotus, thus controlling all objectives. He concentrated his mind on the Supreme Lord. Purport. Samadhi involves concentrating the mind upon the Supreme Cause of all. Even if one is unaware of whether his actual nature is personal, impersonal, or localized, concentrating of the mind on the Supreme is certainly a form of devotional service. To cease from personal sense endeavors and to concentrate on the Supreme is a sign of self-surrender. And when self-surrender is present, that is a sure sign of devotional service. Each and every living entity needs to engage in devotional service to the Lord if he wishes to understand the ultimate cause of his existence. So, the context is Lord Brahma. The principle is setting aside depending upon our own little capacity and taking instead this acceptance of the necessity of depending upon the capacity of someone greater than us, the Supreme, and submitting oneself or surrendering oneself unto that Supreme, pranipat, in language of Bhagavad Gita. Submission or self-surrender. I'm turning unto you, O Supreme Lord, for your kind mercy to illumine something that one has an attraction for, an interest to understand. In his case, it's to understand himself. I can't figure it out. Where I've come from, what the cause is, what I'm supposed to be doing, I can't figure it out. I've made my efforts. They're not fruitful. I surrender unto you. Like what Arjuna did in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. And again, Prabhupada says, to cease from personal sense endeavors and to concentrate on the supreme cause is a sign of self-surrender. And when self-surrender is present, that is a sure sign of devotional service. Each and every living entity needs to engage in devotional service of the Lord if he wishes to understand the ultimate cause of his existence. His spiritual master is Vishnu.
How does the knowledge imparting into the heart like that?
In a way, it's something that's there and awakens. Bhakti Vinod Thakur uses the phrase svatak siddha jnana. It's already there. Or, like Prabhupada said, I've come not to teach you something new, but to remind you of that which you have forgotten. That's imparting knowledge. It's already there. So awaken by sound vibration, spiritual sound vibration, spirit soul that's asleep. The spirit soul that's asleep becomes awakened of knowledge which he has forgotten because it's of the same spiritual nature. The soul that's asleep, it's forgotten knowledge and the source that isn't asleep, hasn't forgotten, is bearing that spiritual vibration, imparting the spiritual vibration, awakens that knowledge, imparting knowledge, awakening knowledge that's dormant. It's not something that's outside that you have to get. It's something that's inside that has to awaken, and we can't do it on our own. It's the Vedic arrangement. It's a very nice arrangement. Very personal. Yes?
I was thinking while you were talking about this fantastic description of creation, Mahavishnu, and his beauty and things like that. And certainly in a preaching setting, it helps to have a general, like a Vedic worldview of things, and you know, like how you were saying, you know, the distance between sun and earth is correlated science. So, in this preaching setting, it helps to say, you know, Vedas have something that correlated science, and it helps their faith also.
Yes.
But I was thinking from my own understanding, how is this important in, like, you know, our daily
the practical life, application question?
In our daily devotional life.
Because I've covered this section a little bit before I left that out, but I was thinking probably a good idea to include it. Here's two or three things. One, our modern education encourages us to question and even challenge. Well, how do you know? Why must it be like this? And it's part of that investigative spirit, according to modern science, that leads to all kinds of breakthroughs and, you know, creative ways of figuring out how to, like, you know, bring sense gratification into play. Like, discover some law of nature, and rather than just... So, it's encouraged. So, on the side of faith, if we don't have a clear idea, either ourselves or in discussion with others that don't accept, our faith may be weakened or tested or challenged if we don't have an understanding. If we just, like, everything comes from God, well, on what basis do you have that notion? Well, the Bible tells me so. It was one of the things that happened, Sadaputta shared this with me, that made research into the Vedas weakened, is because creationists were going around to universities saying, you know, the Old Testament story, in a like, that's it, because it's in the Old Testament. And then science would say, well, wait a minute, what about this? And wait a minute, what about that? And wait a minute, what about the other thing? And their only reply was, well, it doesn't say that in the Bible, so we don't accept it. And so the scientific community just said, you know, get out of here, you guys, you know, you creationists. See, that just shows this is blind faith, and this is substantial. What we have is substantial. So, what's our position? We're not the Old Testament creationists, and you know, we have upbringing, like, you know, years and years and years of it in academia with what science says, and look at the wonderful thing that science has done. It's got, you know, so many nice things that never were around before. Why? Because, you know, they've got a hold of, you know, reality and truths and, you know, how things are. And those scientists say there's no God, so why should we accept that there's God? So, to help answer those why questions or what questions, it's there to help nourish. Otherwise, what are we doing? It's like, you know, closing our eyes and following, blindly following. That's not advised. So if it's not advised, what's the alternative? Where does everything come from? That's a tato, that's the first aphorism of Vedanta Sutra. What's the source of everything? That the absolute truth is that from which everything comes. So Krishna declares, aham sarvasya prabhavo, okay, can you break that down a little bit, please? Here it is. It helps to, the practical side is it helps us, it helps in the faith department, because otherwise it's blind. Here's another one. Another one is, all around us is matter. Look in any direction, up, down, sideways, backwards, and forwards. There's matter. The Vedic perspective is matter comes from God. So we're surrounded by matter that comes from God, at least conceptually. So how does that work? You know, like Sankhya, the 24 elements and then the soul. So there's matter. And Sankhya describes how matter comes from the expansion in this canto, third canto. Kapila Deva is describing to Devahuti, his mother, the unfolding of the elements. from the energetic source of those elements. That's just the elements. Here's Lord Brahma putting the elements together, but the elements that he assembles come from the Supreme. So here we are. What's the correlation between this place where we live that has material elements and our nature? On what basis, what's the logic or scriptural basis for devotional service? We can say we can utilize something in God's service. What's the basis for that? Because if we don't have the basis for it, then we should take the position of the impersonalist, you're supposed to reject it. Well, the basis is it has a connection with the Supreme Lord. Oh yeah? What's that connection? It's going to be described. And there's a purpose behind that connection. One is the conditioning purpose and the other is the liberating purpose. To give us an opportunity to engage in yajna or sacrifice to Vishnu, third chapter Bhagavad Gita. So what's the scriptural basis for that, the support? It comes from him. A little more detail, please. It gives us strength of authority for the life of devotion. Because otherwise, you know, going back to the first one, it's just blind faith. For the Bible tells me so. There's a little song like that. So, faith in authority, when Tamal Krishna Maharaj, who didn't complete his college education after 35 years or something as a devotee, decided he wanted to go back and complete his college education, and he ended up getting his PhD from Oxford University. But in the undergraduate area, which he hadn't completed, he did that at SMU, and he did it, you know, because of his unique position, they gave him a special office as an undergraduate, and, you know, treated him with some dignity, which was deserving. And he wrote many papers on, he was planning, because he's very intelligent, that he would publish a book from his undergraduate papers on the theme of faith and reason. And it's a theological issue, not just for Hare Krishna folks, but for anyone. On what basis, this is, you know, on what basis to accept God, or what basis to accept the authority of Scripture that tells us about God? There's some faith, but how do you balance in reason? Because faith should be reasonable. But it's not, reason doesn't generate faith. So it's a very interesting book, especially for college students or persons that have the capacity for, a well-developed capacity for reason. On what basis? There's reason why we accept the faith of what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita and what the Bhagavatam says about this process of creation. If you don't have that information, you don't have the basis of reason. Nor will you have faith sufficient. When faith is immature, some challenges present and it can break that faith or severely challenge that faith. And if scriptural basis supported by reason is strong, then faith doesn't move. And one can help another who doesn't have strong faith or sufficient faith to take some steps along the spiritual path based on both faith and reason. So it gives that foundation both for oneself and for others. Similar to what you had said, but that's the practical application. Say it the other way around. If we don't understand all this, are we prevented from going back to Godhead? No. But it's there to help not just that it's there, okay, so some people have looked at it, they've understood it, so and they're okay with it, so I'm okay with it because they're okay with it. That's all right, but it makes one's intelligence stronger, and it makes one's faith stronger, it makes one's capacity to help others stronger. Just like, you know, as you said, it gives you the foundation, practically speaking, for moving forward with confidence that has been carefully contemplated. But the last thing I'll say is the devotees from the Bhaktivedanta Institute invited a physics Nobel laureate, Professor Henry Staff, S-T-A-P-H, to take a sabbatical, go to the Bhaktivedanta Institute in Juhu for a month and a half, and study the Sankhya philosophy of Lord Kapiladeva. And the assignment was, please let us know if there's anything in that that's fault, that modern science would say it's in direct contradiction. Or you could say it's falsifiable based on modern science. And his conclusion was, it's not false. There's nothing that he knows of in modern science that could claim this is wrong. It's falsifiable. It doesn't say it's right, but it's not wrong from anything that's in modern science. So, you know, I'm not a Nobel laureate. I don't have that capacity, and I can't read Sankhya philosophy with that capacity in my, you know, in my grip. But one who has done so, you know, doesn't make it right from an empiric point of view, but, you know, it strengthens one's faith. Especially when, you know, these devotees that have associated with this professor, Nobel laureate professor, you know, a brilliant person. And Rasaraj was describing to me, the man was really austere for a non-devotee. He was up at 3 o'clock every morning. Not because, you know, he was like ordered to do that, but he was just, his own discipline is, he was up at 3 o'clock every morning. Because he was staying at the Bhaktivedanta Institute, so he would look over the balcony at 4:30 in the morning and see Mangalarti every morning from the balcony. And he did his whatever his morning thing was, I don't know. And then he, you know, all day long, 12 hours a day, for a month and a half, poring over Srimad Bhagavatam, Sankhya philosophy. Intense guy. Brilliant mind. I find nothing, you know, and then he wrote a little booklet and published it in journals. So, that's just on the faith department. But then that's practical. Because if you don't have faith, how can you go forward? And if you haven't even looked at, well, what's the basis of my faith and how strong is that faith? It's not unwholesome or like bad. You shouldn't question things. You should question things thoughtfully, not in a challenging spirit, but in a thoughtful manner. And but the fruit of that is substance. And you can move forward with confidence. That's practical, the practical application. So go backwards, that's that one. Philosophical foundation for justifying devotional service. Because otherwise, how do you justify it? If we're spirit, soul, and this is all matter, then we should just like have nothing to do with matter. Why do we involve ourselves in devotional service with senses and sense objects and things? Because it's also part of Krishna. And it, therefore, it's on that basis, it can be offered to Krishna. Although he doesn't need anything. It's our benefit to offer things to Krishna, because otherwise we'll be attached to those things. in some manner. Like this question yesterday evening about attachment of using things. It's detachment. It's the means of detachment, but what's the philosophical or scriptural foundation and basis of support for that? We should be alert and thoughtful, not just like a blind follower and, you know, one donkey is moving ahead of us, so we just follow the donkey that's in front of us. Just go along the path and mindlessly do things. That's not good. Material life has a lot of that, and spiritual life is not successful just by being a follower. One has to be thoughtful. So this is the substance that helps us with that basis for devotional service. And the world around us is the other one. You know, anywhere you look, there is matter. What is this? And the natural curiosity that's age old is addressed with scriptural authoritative explanation. Anything else?
Yeah. I was just curious. So, in the schools that we have in Mayapur and Vrindavan, so what kind of is this the part of the curriculum? Like, explaining the world around us,
Brahma. I don't know. I you know, a lot of the schools in Mayapur and Vrindavan, they're very simple because they're children. They certainly have like the frame of references. The frame of reference is the Vedic model. But to what extent they go into it, I don't know. I don't have any experience. I don't know. I would imagine, and this is just like imagining, I would imagine that a lot depends upon the students themselves and the capacity of the students, how deeply it's gone into. I know in the VIAG, Narayani teaches it thoroughly. It's part of the Bhakti Vaibhav study. Because it's there, you know, in the first six cantos. There's several places. Particularly the fifth canto, the structure of the universe. You know, so they have three-dimensional models of the vertical universe and where the planets are, and you know what it says here, what it says there. It seems, you know, this is graduate study, this Bhagavatam. That's Bhakti Vaibhav. But the preliminary certainly is presented. The Vedic Planetarium is going to do more for the public because it's going to be visible with explanations going around the perimeter of the Temple of Vedic Planetarium at each of the levels of what the structure of the universe is. It's going to be very educational for people, worldly people, like non-skilled people, non-technical people. This is the Vedic picture. Here's the explanation around the perimeter, and there it is. A whole chandelier that moves. Like a chandelier that's as big as, you know, several stories. Mechanically moving. As the universe is moving. And vertical dimensions to it. But that's after the universe is created. This is before it's created. I don't know what they're planning to do in the planetarium with that. Okay. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.